Hello, everybody. I'm happy to introduce Alan, who will tell a bit more about Apache Drill and its superpowers. Thank you, Alan.
Thank you. Well, first of all, thank you all for coming today. You, the gentleman on the back row there, can you hear me? Look, we don't care. Can you hear me? Yes. But do you want to hear me? Okay. So whenever I do these talks in different cities, I usually try to start with a beginning slide that actually has a photograph that I've taken at some point from that particular city, just for something, you know, a little connected here. And so I took one here in Las Vegas. Oh, I'm sorry, that's the wrong Paris. And so we just get on the right page here. I want to talk about Apache Drill and its superpowers, a very different sort of setting than the other very expert, very technical talks you'll have today. You have Ted, I see Aman is here in the back, he's speaking this afternoon. Charles Gibb comes right after me. I don't see him in the audience right now, but he'll be here. And so if you have these, you know, deep series questions about Drill, those are the people to go to. My talk's going to be a little different. I want to put Drill in a context, but I think this is an incredibly important aspect of using this technology, but also for the Drill community itself. And what I mean by that is the Drill community goes way beyond the people who actually build Drill, way beyond the people who answer questions on the mailing list. The most important part in many ways of a community are the people who actually use that technology and the context in which they use it. Ted alluded to this a little bit. So I'm going to show you some contextual situations beyond the one that Ted talked about today that use some particular superpowers of Drill. Drill does many things and does them well. Some of those are done well by other similar technologies, but there are some aspects of Drill that really are unique. And I think they are greatly under-recognized by the larger community. And I don't want people to miss out on this. People who use Drill may not even recognize that they can do these certain things, and I think that's important too. Most people who use Drill are using it in very creative ways, and they're getting a lot of value out of it. Okay, so that's the context of my talk today. I am a committer for Apache Mahout and Apache Drill projects. I've also been a big supporter of the Flink project, though I'm not a committer. This is my contact information, and I'll repeat that at the end. I've written a number of books for O'Reilly Media. I didn't put this up. Also one for Manning on Apache Mahout long ago. And so my role is more in the idea of communication and building the community than certainly writing the code itself. Now, Drill really is a very innovative technology. People use terms like that loosely, but in Drill's case, it deserves it. And my hat's off to the people who planned this, people who built it, some of whom are right here in the room. Very interesting as an engineering question, and just top-notch engineering went into building Drill. It really is an innovative technology, groundbreaking and so forth. What makes some innovative technologies successful? They really find traction, and some less so. Thoughts from the audience? Well, part of it, obviously, is it has to be built well. It has to do what it's intended to do. You have to have real vision on the part of the designers and the engineers who build an innovative technology. But it turns out you have to have, what you have much less control over, you have to have real vision on the part of the users. If something actually is new, it's new, it's different, it's not just another tool to do the same thing slightly better and slightly faster. If it's really new, to get full value out of that, the people who use it have to have real vision to see how it can fit in their particular situations. And that is a piece that's kind of intangible. It pays off enormously when it works well. And so my talk's going to look a little more on the vision of the user side. And so before I go any further, the people here in the room, who here has actually used Drill before? Okay. You've used Drill. Okay. Ted has used Drill. Okay. Who's new to it, maybe heard of it, but just haven't even dabbled with it yet, if you don't mind. Yeah. Well, that's great. So we have a real mix. Okay. So here we go. I want to give a plug for this book, and I highly recommend it. This Drill book was written by Charles Gibb, who will be the next speaker after me this afternoon, and Paul Rogers. Charles I find particularly interesting in his kind of path to be here today to talk about this book and so forth. Charles actually started off as a drill user. Yes?
I'm not sure if Charles is coming yet. So let's wait until he actually...
Charles may be here.
I'm not.
But thank you. But I also still say, I highly recommend this book. Charles started off as a drill user. I remember I first met him years ago in Washington, D.C. at a MAP-R event. He was talking about how he used drill and wanted to get more involved. And at this point, correct me if I'm wrong, I think Charles is actually right now the director, or the chairman of the PNC for drill, and has written this book with Paul and gotten very, very involved. So in terms of Apache, you can see people, you know, Apache's dangerous. you touch a project a little bit and find you're enthusiastic about it and get pulled into it. But I do think, especially Charles, starting as a drill user makes this book even more valuable because you not only have the deep technical expertise by people who, both Charles and Paul, are actually building the project, and so many people in the drill developer team, I mean, had input and reviewed the book and so forth, I think Amon included, but it also has that perspective from a user, and that really matters. So the book is a really valuable resource. Right at the beginning of the book, one of the things I talked about, and I was very pleased to see this in there, are some things about drill that are surprising. So drill does what you expect from a large, scalable SQL query engine. It does the things it ought to do. It does the things that other query engines do. It is surprising in that it is so highly scalable and really robust. It does actually use standard ANSI SQL with a few additions. It's not exactly a match, but very close. So that gives it this enormous familiarity to people who are already very comfortable with using SQL. It can be, for example, faster than Hive because of this aspect of in-memory data buffers, making use of CPU utilization, its ability, drill's ability to transfer between nodes. One of the things that's surprising about drill, it's built to work on these massive data sets, but it actually works on small data sets. You can use it right on your laptop, and so that makes it a much more convenient thing. Drill infers schema from the structure of data. And of all of these things, the two that I think really jump out is how easy it is to use. Ted's referred to that, and that really does expand. It's not just that it's convenient when you use it, but it expands the body of who can take advantage of this, who can make use of it. But the one I'm going to focus on today, the fact that it infers schema from the structure of data, you don't have to predefine the schema, is an enormous thing. And what I find is that people who appreciate that and put it to use are getting great value out of this. For some people, they sort of look at that and go, well, that's nice. And this is not to imply that if you build in schema, if you have optimized data for a particular query, that query won't perhaps be more performant, faster, run, and so forth, or that drill's always faster than everything else. It's simply that it has this additional and very unusual, I think unique, ability in this world that you don't have to predefine to be able to go in and explore data. I'm going to take just a moment. When I talk to people about performance, I think of this analogy in terms of somebody running a short sprint, and you've got everybody lined up on the beginning of the race, the gun goes off, people race really fast, somebody makes it over the finish line that much ahead of somebody else. You start some massive SQL query you've written, and you're trying this with Drill or Hive or Impala or all Presto, all the different choices that you might have in this big data world. And which one will run any particular query faster depends largely on the query, and they're all, you know, pretty fast. One's going to win the race one day, one's going to win the race the other day. But here's the big difference with Drill. It's not what happens from the moment that gun runs off, it goes off, and you run the race really fast. You actually run the query. How long did that query take? Of course, it may need to be fast. If you don't have a particular need for speed, the faster you go is just bragging rights. So it needs to match your situation. But I think what matters more in many situations is what happened to get to the beginning, the starting line of that race. Was it a few hours of preparation? Was it 6 months of grueling preparation for the race? With drill, it may literally be a few hours of preparation. somebody walks in and says, do you want to run a race this afternoon? Sure. What time do you want me there? Is an entirely different thing than you have to prepare for it for 6 months. And it's that aspect, that difference of not having to do months, weeks, months of data preparation, that completely changes how drill can affect people's work. It isn't just that that's more convenient or it saves time. Keep this in the back of your mind with the examples I gave you. It changes the nature of what you're willing to do. It changes the nature of what you're allowed to do, because you don't have to have a giant committee meeting every time you decide, ooh, there's something new I want to get from this data, I'll try a different query. You can do those initial queries very straightforward and very fast. You may later decide that is what you're going after and optimize it or put things into a database. So it's not one doesn't preclude the other. All right, so that's the setting I want you to keep in mind. Drill's superpower is that you don't have to define schema before you query the data. But why does that matter? That gets back to this idea of it's the user vision that's going to make this pay off. So some people with vision think with their eyes closed. They're seeing what could be done, maybe what has not been done before, and that's very different than seeing the thing that you already know is possible. All right. So one way this can be used, why does that pay off? One way this can be used is data exploration. So what? Is data exploration something that really matters, or is it a hobby? Well, I'm going to divert here to something that really has nothing to do with drill, but look at this map for a moment. This is a map of the world in terms of the word in different languages that people use for drinking what I, as an American, usually call tea, unless I'm eating in an Indian restaurant at night, and then it's a different thing, and it's chai. Okay? There are many words that are very close to tea. Okay, what's your first language?
German.
Say tea in German.
Tea.
Almost the same.
Tea.
Tea.
Chai.
Chai.
In Persian.
In Persian. Oh, see, I didn't even know to find that spot on the map. It really falls out, and you see this immediate pattern of difference. So what? Why did that happen? Well, I did a little reading about it, and it turns out that tea came from China. Early explorers, so some of them Dutch traders, went there, got tea from certain areas of China, brought it back by sea, and it got to be very popular. And their word sounded closer to tea, as that tea sound at the beginning. The blue dots show where tea showed up elsewhere in the world via water as a trade. In other cases, tea came from a slightly different part of China. People heard that word as being closer to chai. It was spread overland to these other areas, and you see that as a red dot. There are a few outliers. Some people pointed out, I think this there's a red dot out there, which I think is in Portugal. There's a difference. I think the word in Polish is an outlier. I don't know what the white dots are. Here's the point of that. First of all, I thought that was kind of fun. But even something as simple as exploring data, doing a visualization, maybe somebody just mapped this out. I don't even know why they looked, but they begin to see a pattern. It doesn't mean you right away can say everything that was coastal and came in by waters, came in from Dutch. Obviously, you have to do a lot more research. You have to have more information to correlate this to anything. But as you begin to explore data, you not only find out what you have, and maybe you find out you have what you expected to have. Maybe you're looking for a particular aspect in the data, and you see that, yes, this data is going to tell me what I need to know. And sometimes something completely unexpected pops out, maybe even more valuable than what you're originally looking for. So the ability to explore data is hugely powerful. It's absolutely necessary in certain cases, and it's a great adventure that may pay off in others. Can you explore large-scale data? Partly gets back to, do you have the data and do you have it in raw form? But the other thing is, do you have the time, the means, a tool that makes this feasible? You don't have people blocking resources saying, no, this is all in a database, we can't change what's in there. You know, it has to be practical. And that is that difference that drill is delivering. Now, I don't think people use drill to work this now. However, in a real world situation, there's this wonderful example of a very unexpected value from using drill. So this was actually MapR customer. It's a big European service provider. They had a really serious problem that over, I think, 6 months to a year, they were having complaints come in of poor response time in certain areas. And yet, their way of looking at the quality of service, they had these averages that were coming in terms of service quality, and the average response time was always fine. Why were people complaining? In the areas where they complained, the areas where they didn't, you couldn't see any difference. Response time, these average response times were fine. So this is a really hard problem. They were going to bring in a team and build a sophisticated machine learning model to try to explore all this massive data that they had, these averages of response time, and see if they could find some pattern for where there were problems and where there were not. An engineer at MapR, who actually is not a machine learning expert, but he was their initial contact, and he said, you know, before I do this, let's just explore the data. You've told me what you think you have. Let's look at what's actually there instead of what you assume is there. And he just did some initial exploration of these service logs using Drill. And literally, in a few hours, it was less than a day, he discovered the problem. There's dropped data. It turned out where there was a service problem, the system was optimizing delivery of the service itself as opposed to the metadata to be looking at service quality. So it wasn't recording those logs at all. They're dropped out of the data, and all that was being looked at were averages. So if you drop out all the bad data, your averages look pretty good. But it doesn't actually tell you what's going on. He started off just to say, he didn't think he was going to suddenly find an answer. He said, let's just see what you've got, and we'll start building the system. And literally in a few hours, he found that there were just holes of data in the middle of the country, and they correlated beautifully with where there were service problems. So now they knew what the problem was. And in fact, in this case, they didn't even need to build a machine learning system. It's the fact, you maybe could query something else, but if it would have taken an enormous amount of data prep, you wouldn't have done it. To be able to go in and query these logs directly in the same way that Ted was describing in his talk just had a massive payoff here. Now, Drill was used to discover, to explore the data that was actually there, not the assumptions of what was there. That's one reason that you may want to explore data, is to make sure you've actually got what you think you've got. In this case, Drill was fast. I mean, they could do that fast, but it isn't just the speed that was the issue. And this is a generality. This applies in a lot of situations. It turns out that baked-in assumptions can really mask what's actually going on in a lot of situations. And in this situation, there were two baked-in assumptions that got in the way. One of them was that average response time was what you needed to look at to understand issues with service quality. And the other was that you could only actually analyze data against a data warehouse, not that you could just go in and directly look at raw data. So the company had made those two assumptions. That was getting in the way of them finding out what was going on. Both of those assumptions were wrong, and especially the second one was wrong, because you can make use of Drill in that way and actually explore the data. So it's a lesson that goes way beyond Drill. Baked-in assumptions can get in your way, and it's fine. Everybody's going to have assumptions, but go back periodically and test them and make sure that the data, you have the data, you've persisted data, you haven't optimized and groomed your data down to the point that you can't go back to an original view of what's happening because you've lost that ability to go back and test your own assumptions. This turns out to be how, you know, people who have good SQL skills, I think it doesn't just immediately pop to mind that they say, therefore, I should join a data science team and do machine learning. I mean, that's not like the first skill that pops out when people say, can I do data science? In fact, it's an incredibly useful skill along with the ability to code in Java, to deal with Python. All of these different ways of handling data, of doing data modeling, of doing data engineering are an absolutely essential part of machine learning, deep learning, AI systems, because in fact, the part that people first think of, that exciting, sexy part of, oh, let's go in the mathematics and the algorithm and tweak that algorithm and come up with a new algorithm, all of which is good. But a machine learning model is the learning code, the algorithm trained against data, and that actually changes the model. I mean, data, that original training data literally produces different values in the model. So a training model is very much a function of the data that it was exposed to in training. This absolutely matters. And you have to have huge amounts of data to do this. It has to be handled in very specific ways. You have to know exactly what data you have, and then the data that's going to be used to actually run as the models run in production. All of that data wrangling is an enormous part of the project. It has to be done well and done with understanding your domain knowledge. This paper from Google really points out that little red blob in the middle is the machine learning model. If you do machine learning, you need all of the rest of this stuff to work. And that's a lot of different skills that do not include the ability to write or tweak an algorithm itself. And that becomes true also with systems where now a lot of what's being done is machine learning or AI as a service. You have people with those very sophisticated skills to build the algorithms, kind of do that for you, or it's an automated system. But you still have to end up with the right data, knowing how to prepare the data and extract features. So the ability to do SQL queries and to explore data is an enormous advantage in machine learning. I did a talk in Berlin recently about the things that really matter, data preparation specifically for feature extraction for machine learning. And of these three issues that I talked about, that first one, what is in your data? What's really in your data? You can't just, well, you can. Actually, Ted tells a story sometimes, hilarious. Years ago, he was a data chief scientist for a company that was, I said they did identity theft. They didn't do identity theft. They were tracking down and stopping identity theft. But he was modeling all his, or building these machine learning models for anomaly detection, and he misunderstood the data that they gave him. A column was labeled in such a way, he thought he was looking at possible fraud events. It was actually indicating people who were the data analyst, right, Ted, for those events. It's a miscommunication in terms of what the data is. This can happen in all sorts of ways. It's really important to know what's in the data to make sure that what's there is what you think it is. Drill is a massively useful tool for doing that. Another real-world example goes into this world of security. It doesn't have to be a financial site, although in this story it was a banking site. But the idea is that there are constantly, unfortunately, very clever bad persons who are applying their tremendous, boy, talk about innovation of the user, vision on the part of the user. They're constantly figuring out new ways to attack sites, to do phishing attacks, to steal data, to steal personal information. And the faster that you can figure out how to stop that, how to defeat it, they'll be right there coming up with a new way. So there is no single solution that stops it. You have to have a system that is designed to react fast, to react in a flexible and an agile way, because these attacks are going to keep coming in different ways. In this particular case, I think one way to approach this is to say, if you were a fraudster, what would you do? You have to start thinking like a fraudster to know what are the things that you should be looking for if you're trying to protect yourself. This is a little cartoon version of a real-world set of events that happened at a bank, but this is typical of what can happen. Let's say that someone in the audience didn't get their caffeine that morning. They open their email, and they see an email that looks like it's from their bank, and it says, ooh, we think there may have been a problem with your account. Click this link right here.
This is a problem.
Wow. I didn't know this was going to be that sensitive. Okay.
Oh, we're good.
It says, click this link right here, and it will take you to your bank site and, you know, log in and make sure everything's okay. Which, of course, it should just be read as, hi, I'm a thief. If you're not busy this morning, click this link so I can steal all of your personal login information and get into your site. So what happens is the person, oops, actually does click the link. So instead of going directly to their bank and checking their account, they click a link provided in the email. They see a site that looks remarkably like their bank site, even has all the same images and so forth. Really a good facsimile. It turns out it's actually a fraud site. They try a login. The login may fail. It's not really the site. And then I didn't put this in the diagram, but what one version of what can happen is that they then, you, the smart but caffeine-deprived person who's being a victim here, then get a redirect to a site that says, oops, something was wrong with that login, try again. But that time, it is the real bank site for a second login. Meanwhile, back at the fork, some wonderful little robotic thing here has captured your login information, which could be used right then, or it could be used later, it doesn't matter. And probably later is better, but then it logs in and basically steals your money. If you go through that second login site, you get to the actual bank, you log in, this hasn't happened yet, your account looks fine, you go off, and that buys them some time. Okay, so it's pretty clever. Now, this is done in so many different ways. The problem is, if what banks are looking for in terms of logging events, looking for anomalies, trying to always stay alert, if they're doing these high-level events that are things like, was there a login attempt? Was money transferred? You know, these high-level events, again, certain assumptions there are baked in, and they will mask your ability to see what actually happened. In this situation, you log in, everything looks fine. What looks like you logs in, some money goes out, doesn't look like a problem. Okay, that can be a very hard situation to catch. The way to go after it is to realize that there's enormous amount of detail elements built into those pages in terms of the sequence, the different parts, the different headers, the different images, what IP address was it coming from, and those images on the right side. And if you have logged all of those data, that low-level data, and kept that as raw logs, you can go back and build systems against that that can actually detect what's going on. I mean, in some cases, querying directly with drill is the one way to do it, or a starting place to build systems that can do this detection. In this case, images on the site would load in differently than images on the fraud login. The sequence of when somebody comes in and uses the user ID can be a slightly different timing. There is some pattern. So this is just a little diagram of it. Part of the problem is you want to be able to discover this, but you want to be able to discover it fairly quickly so that you can either totally thwart the attack or at least mitigate the impact. Often the key to detecting this can be found in tiny details, in referential details from the phishing site that are actually referring back to or look similar to the genuine page element. This is a little sample I got from Ted of some real elements that are so complicated. There's so much on this page. There are a number of different things that you can look at, these provisional headers, the user agents, and so forth. But if you have saved all of that low-level data, you have logs, you can go and query that directly, you can build systems that will detect this. The person who first told us about this particular pattern of security issues at bank where he was working, is just an ardent drill user. He's found that so valuable. And he's not usually having to turn to somebody to build machine learning models. Oftentimes these things can be, again, detected by just direct analysis. The point is, there are a number of different situations where this superpower of drill pays off in incredibly powerful ways, but it doesn't start with just, I need to write a SQL query. Is that a good, convenient way to do it? Do I get a pretty fast and performant query? I mean, all of that's true, and you want that to be true, but it's this ability to query raw data, to go in and ask questions with a different rhythm than you would otherwise, and to do it very quickly, suddenly changes the use cases really enormously. And I think part of the challenge that the Drill Project has, people have built an amazing technology that actually does this. How do you deal with the human side? How do you deal with the human side that people need to recognize that? They need to actually save those data and recognize that that can be done in some of these efficient large-scale systems. It's not that expensive. And to recognize that people with these abilities to go in and write a good SQL query can be doing some pretty amazing work for them. And so that is not a rhetorical question, although it sounded like it. I'm going to swing back at the end. We have a few minutes. And I really want to hear back from the audience. how do we get more people to recognize this so they are able to take advantage of it? Before we get to that, I just want to tell you one little story, mostly for fun, but it sets a point, there's a lesson here. And this sounds kind of hand-waving, touchy-feely, but my original background was as a research scientist. I was a biochemist, a molecular biologist. I worked in laboratories. And the ability to reason from data, the ability to do tests, to collect new data, to look at it, to avoid your own biases, to not be damaged by those baked-in assumptions, very much a part of the work that I did. Now, they weren't massive-scale data. People working in these industries with the large-scale data, it's a different thing. It's not a research environment, although in some cases it is. But I think those same principles apply, that humans have really some pretty amazing ability to reason from data, okay? But they need the data, and they need a system that allows them to do that. It's sort of like breathing, allows them to reason in a back-and-forward situation. They ask a question, they do a test, they get some insight that makes them think, oh, no, let me adjust the question, or there's a different question, or wait. You know, I haven't noticed that all the people who say tea live here and all the people who say chai live there. Let me dig into that instead. So it's that ability to follow on your ideas, kind of at the rate that a human thinks and reasons about things. That's what this superpower of Dural is opening up. It's a different way for people to interact with data that becomes, I think, really much more human, much more normal. Instead of big committees and everything having to go against the database, you're able to work with data back and forth in this flexible way that lets you really understand, it lets you act on your instincts and get back them up with solid data. And so, just as a reminder of how important that is, let me tell you a story. So this is, you know, still something baked in, but assumptions can ask what happens. Let me tell you a story that has nothing to do with Dural, but you should have a little entertainment here. How many people have heard of a disease called scurvy? Is there anybody here who's from the UK? Your Navy was famous several centuries ago for actually being able to have people go out at sea for a long time and not get scurvy and not die of scurvy, and it made you able to go all around the world and bring them back and do all kinds of things. Okay, let's take a quick look at this. Scurvy is a terrible disease. It is, and ultimately fatal, it is caused by a lack of vitamin C, which is ascorbic acid. You only need that in very small amounts. Vitamin C is found in a lot of fresh foods, including citrus fruits. This has been known for a very long time, but not uniformly known. I mean, I think even back to classical Greek time, people understood that eating certain fresh vegetables or watercress or having citrus fruit, you wouldn't develop scurvy. It first got a touch sort of scientifically when a physician, James Lynn, did some experiments, actually on sailors aboard a ship. I don't think that would be quite allowed today. But he paired up groups, I think six groups, two each, of sailors who were very ill on that voyage with scurvy. And a lot of different things people had thought might work. And so he tested each of them. He gave each of them a different treatment. I can't remember all of the wild things they were, but group number six got two lemons and an orange each day. And within just a very few days, they recovered to such an extent that they could help nurse the other ones where they started giving them citrus. And so he actually published this paper. Now, it didn't get acted on right away, but after some period of time, people came to understand that he really had figured out how to prevent scurvy. And he made one small mistake. He didn't really have a way to test it. He didn't know why citrus was preventing scurvy. He thought it was the acidity of the lemons. That was the issue. It isn't the acidity. It's the fact that it has vitamin C in it, but that's fine. It is true that if you eat fresh lemons and you don't need a whole lot of it, you will be protected against scurvy. He published this treatise of scurvy, of the cure for scurvy, and this made a huge impact, really, on British history. It meant that their sailors could be out at sea and be healthy for a longer period of time. And then some interesting things happened. They were required to use lemon juice. They had to trade to get the lemons. They don't grow in the UK. Global warming, maybe they will soon, but they didn't back then. But this was really giving the British Navy a huge advantage. And so why is it, I read this article in a 1911 expedition to one of the poles, a physician there was bemoaning the fact that everybody on this overland expedition were getting ill and dying of scurvy. And he said, if only people had any idea how to cure this illness, if only we knew what the cause was. Maybe it's caused by darkness or too much cold or hard work or, you know, doing too much programming in a basement late at night. Somehow it had dropped out, or we didn't have fresh fruits and vegetables and whatever. How could he not have known that? How did they undiscover the cure for scurvy? What happened in between there? We in science have a term for this called, broken reasoning. What happens, this is described in this book, The Worst Journey in the World, but what basically happened is a set of baked-in assumptions that were not well-tested and were just slightly wrong, and step after step after step got built based on those slightly wrong assumptions. You start off right and you start going slightly wrong, and people weren't going back to the original data, to the original assumptions, and retesting to figure out what fell out of the reasoning. And quickly, the sequence that happened is the British Navy decided it would be even better if they could use limes instead of lemons because they could grow that in the West Indies and so forth. Limes are slightly more acidic than lemons, so they reasoned that this would work even better for scurvy, thinking it was the acidity. What's wrong here? Well, limes actually do prevent scurvy. They do have vitamin C, although they have about a fourth as much as a lemon, but plenty enough to prevent. Fresh lime will definitely keep you safe. However, it wasn't the acidity that was the issue. But they couldn't tell that. The assumption was masked because if you give somebody a lime and they don't get scurvy, you go, yes, it's working. Must be the acidity. And then after carrying these fresh limes on ships for a long time, they realized, well, that's pretty inconvenient. What if it was lime juice? Well, fresh lime juice, take a lime, squeeze it into a glass and drink it, that will absolutely prevent scurvy. There's enough vitamin C in there to protect you. How would you do that for large-scale production to supply all these sailors? Well, you would take these limes in huge amounts. You would put them in these open vats exposed to the air. You would heat them, extract the lime juice. You would pipe it through copper pipes, put it in bottles, and put it on a ship and have people drink their dose of lime juice every day. What are some of the things that deactivate vitamin C? Exposure to the air, exposure to heat, and exposure to copper. Okay. But then, wouldn't they just notice right away? They take a bottle of lime juice, they go out and see a bunch of people get sick. They weren't getting sick. And for years, they went on, they were doing okay. And they kept swilling back their lime juice and thinking they were fine. More false assumptions down the road. And what happened is, it takes a long time to develop the symptoms of scurvy. I think it's 4 to 6 months of vitamin C deficiency before you start getting really sick. And the sea voyages had gotten shorter and faster. They were more effective. They had better navigation, which is a whole different interesting story. And they were beginning to even get, you know, steam powered and so forth. And so the voyages were short enough that for years, for decades, people had been drinking lime juice, bottling this way. It really was ineffective, but they couldn't tell. They'd go back home, have a nice dinner for a fresh food, and they'd be fine. And they thought they were fine. And then they did this long polar expedition where they really were away for a long period of time, and they started getting sick. And instead of going, like, where, we know it worked before, what happened? They just go, well, that was totally wrong. We must have had no idea about the cure at all. It really was quite some years later before they figured this out. Fortunately, someone did figure this out, and they actually identified the component with vitamin C. But this is this whole set of steps and reasoning. They weren't entirely wrong, but they were just wrong enough. And when things start going down the line, sometimes it starts not making sense. What you need to do is go back to the details, go back to the raw data, go back to your very earlier assumptions and retest them. You want to be able to go back and query those logs files directly. And in a modern world, this is something that in a lot of different situations, Drill is making it possible to go back and find out why your data is now getting stored, okay, and why it used to not. So the ability to query data without weeks and months of preparation changes how people reason, and that really opens up some interesting possibilities just beyond I can write a really good SQL query for the impact of Drill as a project. So I think I have about 5 minutes, 10 minutes?
10.
So I just want to open this up now to hear from the audience, people who are using Drill, people who are thinking about using Drill and haven't used it yet or have toyed with it really, is situationally, what's the context in which you think it might be useful to you? What would you use it for if you do use it? And I'm going to start since I picked on these two gentlemen I talked to earlier from the UK. If you're willing to share a little bit about your thoughts about Drill, we'd love to hear from you.
Yeah, I mean, common use case of Drill, so going back a few years, of course, before there was a whole array of SQL interfaces to run over a whole bunch of different data platforms and resources and what have you. You know, Drill provided the ability to have a JDBC compliant data source that you could plug your end users' analysis tools into a data source that previously had no way of being able to. People understand data. You know, I do a lot of data processing. I don't pretend to, you know, if I was looking at scurvy stuff, I wouldn't pretend to understand data, but I can transform it in a way that I can give it to end users. But if they have to then go and log into a black and white terminal and write some crazy SQL query, it's not going to get very far because they're going to get bored and it's not like their micro strategy or whatever they're using beforehand. Mm-hmm. So Drill facilitates easy access for people who actually understand the data they're looking at. That platforms prior to Drill just never really ability to do. The other thing as well was when Drill came out, it was the first platform that I've used it ever, I think, that was JDBC compliant and ANSI compliant that allowed all these tools that create SQL on the fly to connect it, which doesn't normally happen because things like Cassandra has its own SQL variants, and of course MongoDB came out and was here that has some crazy JSON query structure. You know, sticking to stuff that people know and understand the tools we use was something that's quite important.
Well, that's a great example, and it also underlies this bigger issue. Again, I talk to people a lot about machine learning, so I think about it in that context, but it doesn't need to be machine learning. But you have this separation. I think Ted alluded to that too. You have this separation between people who have the particular technical skill that's needed in terms of coding or whatever, and they may not be the same group of people who have the really important domain knowledge, which is what makes all of this make sense. And somehow that has to get together in some way. And so it's wonderful if they're building a bridge. Do you think you might dabble with Drill a little more?
We have it kicking around with our servers. We do use it from time to time. It's a tool that, like I was saying, you can download and get started really quickly and use it. So, it does provide, if I've had got some crazy JSON file that I need to go to try and extract some information from, chuck it into Drill and see if I can pass it and get some stuff out that way.
Okay.
A quick start that just gets us off to. Flying to that. And of course, you can then write that stuff out to different formats from within Drill. The flexibility it provides in getting data out and writing it into a structure that's more useful, again, is something that, allows us to transform that data pretty quickly.
Well, take advantage today, get lunch or break or whatever, grab them on Ted. If you have any more specific questions, they can drill down. someone else who's either using Drill or thinking about using Drill? Yes, sir.
So,
Vishal?
Yeah, Vishal.
Great.
So I was wondering, how does it compare to something like PrestoDB?
How does it compare to?
PrestoDB?
I'm throwing that question back to Aman.
So Presto is also a Java-based query, similar to Drill. They both do MVP-style data processing. I think a couple of key differences are that Drill basically has a direct memory, it built the usage of in-memory value vectors and things like that, which are not in the Java heap. I believe Presto does use, I'm not 100% sure, but I think it does use Java heap. The other things are related to the plugins. Trim actually does have a pretty extensible set of plugins that you can like, create your own very easily. But at the end of the day, there is a fair amount of commonality in these types of plugins. You would have to look at a little more nuanced items to see which one is more differentiated and works better in one case. So one of the things I would say is differentiator is the support for secondary indexing that you will add in. So if you're coming from sort of a database type of background, right, and you want to run your query and leverage indexes from your like, NoSQL database, then Presto does not do that.
I think also you asked specifically, thank you a lot, by the way, for my answer, specifically a comparison to Presto. But I also see situations where people are not relying on just one SQL tool. And so they may have specialized situations where they want to use one of these other tools, or they have people who already, that was their favorite thing. But they still are using Drill, again, maybe for the data exploration and for different kinds of queries or taking advantage of the secondary index. And so situationally, they may use both for different reasons. Yes?
Just to jump in and add a little bit to that as well, is the fact that Drill has a multitude of data sources and counts like stuff powering bits and pieces of the world. You can use Drill very conveniently for data federation and bringing different data sources together that aren't necessarily all in the same place. So you've got a MySQL database doing one thing, you've got some files doing another thing, you've got some stuff that's going around in a Hadoop cluster somewhere. You can query those as a single integer here, integer to a single table, and you can obviously do a lot of stuff across different data sources and just make it come together as one and then expose that to a user. So that type of stuff is pretty useful from a Drill perspective, just to allow people to federate different data sources together.
Yeah.
That's also like on similar lines.
Yeah, but one other thing I just remembered was like more recently, Presto only recently added a cost-based optimizer, which was, which Drill, because of the Drill integration with Elsec, has been there from day one. And so there's, you would probably very likely see significantly better query plans in Drill compared to Presto. I remember, like simple things like filter pushdown and things like that in Presto were not being done cost-based. Until maybe like 6 months.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
Question about the storage plugins, specifically around the Amazon S3. I believe it was originally, Drill was originally paired with the HDFS, right? So my question is, do you see people use Drill with the S3 in production nowadays? And is there storage or any thing to watch out for that?
They are being used against S3. I don't have any examples that top of my mind, but there have been several based on the emails that have come across on the vendors asking about S3s and something about authentication and things like that. I assume that people are using S3s.
Chad?
Sorry, Chad.
Wake you up back there, but this gentleman was asking about Drill against S3 data, and Aman has verified that that can work. But do you have any particular stories of people doing that?
Yeah, but I think I have a really biased sample. People use S3 because they can't have storage scales. It's a workaround. So you lose semantics, you have a term for scale. And with Mapari, tiered S3 that maintains APIs and file appearance. And so Mapari users tend not to use S3 because they don't need to work with it. It's my understanding that people who are not tend to use S3 and Drill more commonly. But my own experience is heavily biased.
I'm going to leave you guys. By the way, audience, thank you so much for sharing ideas as well. Do connect with these other people, connect with each other, and share these stories. But also, please email me on the SEO list of contact information, your idea here. The Gamma Plug for the book. Please support women in technology. It's good for society. And for One Woman in Tech, I say thank you. That's my contact information. But I would also like to hear back about how people are using Drill, and if you have good ideas about how the community as a whole can more easily collect and harvest this information about specific questions like what you asked, just it's being used in what context for what. Years ago, I used to suggest people go on the user list, and that would be fine, but I don't think that's a good way to collect that information. I haven't come up with a really good way. Maybe through some other channel. But if you come up with a good information, if you have good stories, send it to me, and I'll try to be a little bit of a repository for you as well. Thank you all so much for coming. I really appreciate it. Thank you.